Okay, we're gonna go ahead and get started. I'd like to welcome everyone to the second full day of Socialism 2009. My name's Laura. I'm a member of the International Socialist Organization in Los Angeles, and this is the meeting on the revolutionary ideas of Charles Darwin. Is capitalism natural? Our speaker is Andy Lipson. He's a member of the ISO in San Francisco. He's a science teacher at Mission High School, and he has a PhD in biochemistry and biophysics. So we're going to get started.
Okay. This is the 150th anniversary of this book, Origin of Species. It was published in November 1859, and it was pretty much a gunshot when it came out. But actually, the biggest force around the Origin of Species was a debate that took place 7 months after the publication of this, in June of 1860. It was a debate that took place in Oxford University. And on one side of this debate was a prominent bishop called Sam Wilberforce, who was one of the most famous orators in London. He was a powerful member of the church and a mathematician and studied birds. Also on that, Captain Fitzroy, who had actually been the captain of the HMS Beagle, the trip that Darwin took that 5 years, which is really documented in this. And Captain Fitzroy, the very same trip that had convinced Darwin of a theory of the transformation of species, had helped convince Captain Fitzroy of the truth, the literal truth of the Bible and the story of Noah's Ark. So that was that's on one side of the debate. On the other side was a botanist called Joseph Hooker and a famous biologist and friend of Darwin called Thomas Huxley. And one of the things you'll notice about this debate and subsequent public debates that took place right after the publication of Origin of Species is really Darwin was at none of them. Darwin, he was sick and things like that, but there's really a lot of ideas about why Darwin wasn't at these debates. I think the biggest one is that Darwin was just a nice guy. And one fellow scientist said, you're just as good as your grandfather. You're a really good goose. He described him as a good goose. Fortunately, Darwin's friends, Charles Lyell, Joseph Hooker, and Thomas Huxley, were not so nice. And here's what Huxley wrote to Darwin. He said, "Some of your friends are endowed with an amount of combativeness, which, though you often rebuke us for it, may stand you in good stead. I am sharpening up my claws and beak in readiness," and in readiness, really, for this debate. And Thomas Huxley referred to himself as Darwin's bulldog. And so what this debate was at Oxford was 1,000 people were coming there, hundreds had to be turned away, and it was the greatest orator in England, Wilberforce versus Darwin's bulldog. And Wilberforce spoke first and went through really some of the scientific problems that he had seen in Darwin's Origin. He quoted other scientists who had problems with what Darwin was writing about, and of course talked about how it challenged and really threatened the eternal order of God. But I think Wilberforce's most famous line is how he finished the debate, and he said this to Huxley. He goes, "Mr. Huxley, is it through your grandfather or your grandmother that you claim descent through a monkey?" And, you know, calling out his parents or grandparents, that's pretty bad. It reminds me more of, Jerry Springer than anything else. But people were really, there was that response. It was a kind of a hushed response because Thomas Huxley was getting up. And he's going to be now responding to one of the most powerful figures in London at the time. And Huxley says this pretty much right off the bat. He goes, "I would rather be the offspring of two apes than be a fool afraid to face the truth." And the crowd pretty much erupted. And supposedly a woman aristocrat, friend of Wilberforce, called Lady Brewster, she fainted to see him reproached this way in his own diocese. But the bitterness of this battle, which really was a bitter battle at the time, really reflected not just a battle between science and religion, but it was really a battle between a growing capitalist class at the time seeking to utilize science and theory to shape and reshape the world versus the staid church still foisting up an old feudal way of nobility, kings, and a static order. And many scientists saw themselves as part of a vanguard of this new order. Ernest Haeckel, a German embryologist, articulated the battle this way. On one side, spiritual freedom and truth, reason and culture, evolution and progress stand under the bright banner of science. On the other side, under the black flag of hierarchy, stand spiritual slavery, falsehood, irrationality, barbarism, superstition, retrogression. I mean, he's laying it out here. But he said this. He ends with this. Darwin's theory of evolution is the heavy artillery in the struggle for truth. And decades later, after The Origins of the Species was published, the world would really be transformed into the world it is today. From a 19th century world, static world, driven not by the purposeful hand of God, but a 20th century world of change, of adaptation, of transformation, of innovation, and of possibility. And where really, God's hand was not necessary. It was removed from its movement. And it was, again, more of a world of possibility. And in one case, you can see this as a step down for humans, because they were placed from atop the natural world and just firmly rested within it. But in another way, it really was empowerment, because it empowered humans, not just God, to seize the role of shaping their environment. And certainly the capitalist class would then go do that. But even Marx saw the possibility of, well, if the capitalist class can seize the world and shape it, then maybe so can the working class. And that's where Marx sees the... Well, I'll draw that connection out later. And it is important to understand that the capitalists and scientists of the day were not actually gracious winners of this battle. Bishop Wilberforce was a broken man after this debate. He just a few years later, he was riding his horse, fell off his horse, hit his head on a rock, and died. Somebody asked Darwin what he thought about it, and he says, you know, it's a real shame. You know, Wilberforce is an honest and good guy. Somebody asked Huxley what he felt about this. And he goes, well, for once, the bishop's brains and reality came into contact. And the results proved fatal. Merciless. Not even a good thing to say after you're dead. So, Sigmund Freud said this about great scientific revolutionary ideas. Is one, they represent an intellectual reformation of physical reality for people. And two, they tend to represent a demotion of humans from dominion atop a pyramid and put them as part of a simple result of a natural process. And I really think he was talking about just Charles Darwin there. And even his own ideas, I think, reflect that. And I will spend some time in this talk to explain what Charles Darwin's ideas are, how they impacted the world today and changed the world of yesterday, and talk about the real debates that do exist within the science community and among regular folks. But what I'm not going to discuss too much is intelligent design. I believe that debate was settled roughly 100 years ago, but I will say something about the debates that seem to only occur here in the United States and say that they really actually represent a political debate, not a debate about science or religion or political battle. But it is worth going back first and considering what constituted mainstream ideology back in the 19th century in both public and scientific spheres. And I'll start with an analogy you may have heard by William Paley of the watch and the watchmaker, to an analogy he basically made about nature and God. Basically, in that analogy, Paley is talking about a natural world which shows such perfect design that each piece has a unique role and fitted in coordination with other pieces. And nature represents this sort of coordination. In that way, he was likening nature to a watch. And he said, if nature is like this watch, it's so perfectly coordinated and adapted, everything's adapted to its own environment, then certainly there must be a designer, a perfect designer for this. And that perfect designer, he said, was God. And this was not just an idea among common people that other scientists didn't believe. Isaac Newton, very smart guy, basically believed this kind of stuff. Pascal, and I'll mention Linnaeus, who came up with this thing here in a second, also did that. What were those common categories of ideas represented essentialism and teleology. And I'll say something about those philosophic ideas that were underpinning people like Newton, Pascal, and the ideas of the day. Essentialism is the idea that everything in the world has a unique and fixed purpose. And the important part of that is fixed. That any variance from that purpose really is a deviation that's strange and out of place. So each watch has small cogs and big hands and small hands, and that's what they're there for, and that's their fixed purpose. A second part of essentialism is the notion that the material world is sort of a shell of the real world, but the real world should not be understood by its material shell, but by its spiritual essence. And really the best example of that is the human soul. The human soul, the physical body may change, but really that human soul within us is fixed and invariant. And both of those features are part of essentialism. The things are static, and the material world is a shell hiding a truer, invisible spiritual world. And teleology is the idea that all this stuff has basically a purpose or guiding hand behind it. And of course, in the case of the watch and the watchmaker is the hand of God, which doesn't mean that that means that history has a logical meaning to it and potentially a predictable outcome. And so for people who believe in essentialism and teleology, at best, the material world could be studied only to give hints at this invisible divine order within. And in fact, that's really what Linnaeus had done here. Carl Linnaeus was a scientist, a naturalist, and a religious man, creationist really, who had been 100 years before Darwin, and he had come up with, he had studied thousands of species and really tried to find how they fit in these various orders. He came up with these categories, which are really used today, how species are part of a genus, and those genus are part of a family, and they can be subdivided. And here, all this thing goes down to life. Well, that wouldn't have been what Linnaeus was expecting to find. He would have put God here. He would say, look, this is all about kind of finding, where does God, what's God's work? What's God's way of looking at things? And there must be some reflection in the material world, but we're trying to find an inner essence to it. And really, this is the same set of ideas that Darwin would have had at the time. And he believed in God when he was born, and people make a lot of the fact that he wanted to be a parson growing up. But his real reason for wanting to be a parson was many parsons and clergymen at the time studied the world for the reasons that you saw here. You study the world, you can learn about God. Darwin was a curious guy. His proudest moment, he writes in his memoirs, was not writing Origin of Species or Descent of Man. His proudest moment was basically capturing an unidentified beetle that he got to name and put it into a scientific journal. That was this big thing. And as a 19-year-old, he wrote in his journal, "I am dying by inches from not having anyone to talk to about insects." All right, which might allow you to write Darwin off as a bit of a nerd, which I don't think is true, actually. I think terms like genius and brilliant are often thrown around. I'm not big on those kinds of terms, but I can say there's lots of things you read about Darwin that do suggest a very keen intellect and a very sharp mind. The first thing that I read about him was something his dad said about him. And here's his dad talking about Charles. He goes, "You care for nothing but shooting, insect and rat catching, and you will be a disgrace to yourself and all your family." I think if your dad says that about you, you know you're going somewhere. But beyond that, in really all the descriptions of scientists and other people who knew him, and even other religious people, he's described as a kind person, a listener. People would talk to him, and they would be struck because they were so awed by him. They would be struck by, they spent more of the time talking. He would listen to him and talk to him, ask him questions. He was a very curious person in terms of, and very likable. Captain Fitzroy said this. He said, "He's the only landlubber liked by the crew of the HMS Beagle." And really, my own experience in science. At Johns Hopkins, I met two Nobel laureates. And really, it's really interesting when you do talk to those people. They are very, like, just kind, nice people, but you don't really get the sense they're so smart. They make you feel smart. And really, that's what comes across when I'm reading about Darwin is really confirmed in my own experience in the science community. The people who are the smartest don't have to prove anything, really. There's another feature, though, that I think is really sharp about Darwin, which is any scientist is usually trying to take a series of facts and put them into a trend. And Darwin was exceptional at finding those facts which did not fit into that trend. He was always looking at those areas where something doesn't fit, and was always being honest about it. So if you read Origin of Species, you'll find that about 300 pages of this deals with all the things that don't fit into his theory. He calls them difficulties of the theory, miscellaneous objections, not just had by others, but had by him. Issues of instinct and hybridism, and also the imperfect geological record. He takes up all those questions in this book because he himself had those questions. So any debate you hear about, Darwin had already figured it out, but those debates largely work in terms of, you know, the questions people raise about his theory. So I'd said that Darwin was a nice guy, and that the fact that he was nice actually proved to be a very important part of him writing this book. Captain Fitzroy had a naturalist who was going to be on HMS Beagle, but he couldn't stand the guy. The guy, he just didn't like to talk to him, and they were going to be on the trip 5 years together. And he's like, "I don't want to be 5 years with this guy, eating lunch or dinner with this guy every day." So he got rid of him. And he said, despite the fact that he didn't like the shape of Darwin's nose, he found him to be a sensible, hardworking, and pleasant messmate. And they really had great conversations. The only biggest problem they ever ran into was when they talked about slavery. Captain Fitzroy was for it, and Charles Darwin was against it. And they had big battles over that, or sometimes. So in those 5 years that Darwin is traveling around the world in the HMS Beagle, he was really using those shooting and hunting skills. He also learned how to use a lasso and a three-ball bolo, which I really found really cool that he learned to do that. And he used those things to collect his evidence for his developing theory, collecting fossils. You don't need a bolo to collect fossils, but you get the idea. Birds, bugs, plants, animals. And he categorized, collected or drew thousands of pictures and took copious notes, filling up over 18 field notebooks, six pocket notebooks, and basically also a written journal of over 200,000 words going over all the geological and zoological observations he was making. And it was this pack of information that he collected that made up the origin of the species. And there are two things about all this information that are important. One is Darwin actually, after he came back, used a lot of these notes to write traveling books about his experiences there. It's actually in the 20 years between the HMS Beagle trip and the publication of Origin of the Species, he wrote a number of books about his travels that became very popular. It's how Darwin became known as a public figure. And secondly, part of what made Origin such a stick of dynamite, because other scientists were beginning to come up with this idea of evolution as well, was really the breadth of scientific data that was assembled inside this book that explained Darwin's theory. But again, Darwin had a problem stepping off the Beagle 5 years after he had recorded all this stuff and really came out at that point with a theory, which I'll speak later. The problem was he came back to a world which basically saw the world as only existing 6,000 years ago. So the church and scientists today basically had an exact date for when the world was born, a point I'm going to be talking about over there, which was October 23rd, 9 p.m., 4004 BC. Does not give you a lot of time for that kind of stuff, for these things to take place. But one of the books that Charles Darwin takes with him on the Beagle is a book written by George Lyell called The Principles of Geology. And he's talking about some of these changes I'm going to be marking along the top, which are geological changes, and was really marking out how the Earth, he saw in his own travels, how the Earth had changed over time. And he said, this takes millions of years, hundreds of millions of years. I don't think at that point it was going as far as billions. And so the not just the time frame, but the fact that the Earth itself was changing really impacted Darwin a lot in terms of his own thoughts about what he was seeing in the biological world. And these changes were central to Darwin's conceptions of changes taking place in Earth's biology and laid the basis for moving from a static essentialist view to a dynamic, what became a dialectical view. That is, that the biological world, the one below here, interacts with the inorganic world, just the Earth, and they both interact with each other and they change one another. And in their changing, they make further changes. And that's the dialectical nature of those two things, which I'll say a little bit more. So George Lyell's book was central to his theory. And secondly, two other major things. Thomas Malthus had written a book about the idea of the exponential development of human populations, geometric progression of resources, really explained and then, in his case, justified the immense misery that he saw under capitalism. So lots of people should die, that's just the way it is. And this is what Thomas Malthus had written about. Darwin didn't necessarily believe that was happening in the human world, but he did see something like that potentially happening in the other part of the natural world. And also, he was influenced by what he knew was the domestication of pigeons, of dogs, of horses, of growing apples and plants and things like that. This was basically, he knew that breeders could select for certain properties of creatures by using the variations of the progeny. So an example would be, if you want a fast horse with a long mane, you take the kids of some set of horses, right, female and male horse, and you look for the one that has a long mane, and you look for the one that's fastest, you take that one, breed it to another one like that, and you do that over generation, 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 and you can start to produce kids that are mostly fast and mostly got the long mane and stuff like that. So that was called artificial selection, humans sort of imposing a design. And these laid the basis for Darwin's ideas. So Darwin comes off the when he publishes Origin of the Species, what are the major ideas in this? The first is that he establishes, through a vast examination of the fossil record, that some organisms seems to have progressed to some period of time and died off. That is, there's fossils that have no connection to existing creatures today. And then he saw some where you saw some changes taking place in the fossil record, and they look very similar to creatures that existed at the time. And really, all Darwin said was, well, creatures change, organisms change over time, which maybe not seem like a radical view now, but it was a radical view then. The more radical view that he came up with was not just that creatures change over time and some don't make it and some do, was that all these creatures have a common source. Not necessarily a common source that goes to God, but a common source at some single point. And that I'll talk to later about what that common source was. Common biological source. Darwin describes the process of change from the common source to the variety that is created. He doesn't use the term evolution. He uses the word evolve only one time in this book. It's the last page of the book. It's the last word on the last page. Evolve. Okay? Every other time he's talking about descent with modification. Why doesn't he use the term evolve? First of all, he was aware that the term evolution implied a process that was deterministic, that something was coming into its fixed and natural state. That's essentialist. He wouldn't think that way. And evolution also implies a process of refinement and increased perfection. That's not just true back then. Really, Darwin would not be happy with this right here. Okay, this is like, okay, it's a single line, and here comes this stupid little monkey, and it's become a perfect man eventually. Darwin would not, of course this took place, but this is a very non-Darwinian way of representing these ideas. Darwin did not see nature working in this linear, deterministic way. He saw it as a process that combines both necessity and chance, and involves the interaction and adaptation of an organism with its environment. Here's how Darwin said most people saw evolution at the time. David Zirin just got here. What's this? I'm sure you know what that is, right? You've seen this before, NCAA tournament or wrestling tournament or something like that. And, the idea is all these people have to fight it out, and they beat them out from here, beat them out here. And eventually you get to this human, process of a competition or things like that. That's how most people see evolution. Darwin said, no, it doesn't work out this way. He goes, not upside down necessarily. But he goes, you start from an earlier single source, and really what we're talking about is a process which produces variety. And some of these lines will be cut off because you won't make it, but some will, all right? So human, if the monkey was here, then, maybe the next guy's over here, then over here, and then eventually you get a human right over there. But you have a variety of other species as well, okay? And that's the process that Darwin would describe as evolution. Looked more like that. And you were not, and again, we're moving through time here, so each organism is not fixed, but fitted to its particular time and to its particular circumstances at that given time. If the circumstances change, then the organism may need to change as well. But you can't predict it. It's probabilistic, not deterministic. And so how is that the modern conception? Really, the modern conception that mixes Linnaeus's view of the world, that the color thing you saw before, with Darwin's tournament here, or tree here, is the tree of life, okay? So you can see the human here, it's just a part of the tree, it's just a little branch on it, right? And all of these, this is moving through time, backwards through time along here, you see the various branch points through all the different organisms, you've got the single-cell organisms and different mostly multiple-cell organisms along here. But they all come back to a common root right up along here. And so Darwin would have traced it back to here, and he would have traced that not back to God, but what were described as photosynthetic bacteria. Okay. Now, you might think, okay, photosynthetic bacteria, step down. But you're enjoying that oxygen right now. You might want to thank those bacteria for that. They turn carbon dioxide, okay? They turn a lot of the oxygen we breathe today was because these photosynthetic bacteria, at the time, they existed in this second atmosphere, which had mostly carbon dioxide, very little oxygen. Photosynthetic bacteria appear here. We can breathe now, okay? Third, okay, so they play a large role in producing that oxygen. So his view is humans not at the top of the pyramid, of a life pyramid, but a part of that, right here. And there's nothing deterministic about it. And to note pretty much how this still is that essentialist deterministic view is, again, just think about what this is. This is a man. Really, it's a white man, okay? And it's not a woman. There's a reason it's not a woman, because sexist society is seen as less perfect. This is supposed to be perfect here. And more importantly, I would say, this is a racist society, this is not a black man, okay? And that's just historically inaccurate, okay? Yeah. Everyone now knows that basically the first humans, 200,000 years ago, were black. Yeah. White people, like myself, 50,000 years ago, that's when we came around, okay? So we're a more recent part of the game. All humans, all of us, come from the original black person, all right? Out of Africa, really. So that's known, and these things aren't still changed. So I would state that misconception where those ideas were challenged back then 150 years ago were a bombshell. I think they still need to be challenged today, given all the social and racial biases that exist. So these two parts of Darwin's theory, that the world is, that organisms change, and that they originate from a common source, these really are not up for debate in all this discussion. It's really been proved by fossil records, embryological data, geological data, and most recently in, I don't know how much time to go through this, but the molecular biology data goes through as well. And I just want to say something about how that is the case. Again, you see the tournament, the little thing here, humans, chimps, mice, rat, chick, frog, and fish. And what they've done is they've taken amino acid sequences and compared them. If they're similar, like this human and chimp, you can see are very similar. They're both in blue. They would be put next to each other. But as you move from the mouse to a rat to a chimp, you can see you start to get variations. You see little holes where they don't fit anymore. And the more holes you see, the farther back in time that organism broke off from an earlier organism. And so Linus Pauling came up with this way of looking at protein sequences and nucleotide sequences and really using that data to confirm a time when they were common and confirmed it next to a fossil record as well. Okay. So again, this data exists as well. So like I said, that was not up for debate. The thing which is up for debate, and which scientists still aren't agreeing on, which is the mechanism or the process by which this took place. Darwin called this process, I'll say something about what is debate. Darwin called this process natural selection. So how did this natural selection work? How did we see the spreading out of variety? Well, first, he basically presumes that all organisms produce way more progeny than they can possibly survive. That its biotic potential was bigger than what was realized. So if trout were in the sea and there was nothing stopping them from growing in a lake, in a few generations or many generations, they would just swamp over the whole place. And secondly, that the kids of all trout or in all humans, they're all different than the original parents. There is some variety there. That was the second part of his theory, seeing that all progeny were different somehow than the things that they came from. And third, since he knew that things could swarm over the earth, but they weren't, so somehow they were dying off, and that only actually a small percentage of all organisms survive compared to what is possible, and since all their progeny are different from one another, then there must be some basis for selecting which ones live and which ones die. And in the case of artificial selection, humans pick, I want a fast horse, or I want a crunchy apple, or something like that. But in the case of nature, it applies a similar selection, but not actively in the same way that humans do. It basically applies a filter through what was called the struggle for existence. That is, the existence of different predators and prey different predators and who was the prey could decide. Diseases could affect it. The availability of food and resources could decide who lives and who survives. And what variation tended to have a more favorable chance of surviving over hundreds of thousands of generations, this is a statistical process, would take a long time, would then produce a particular outcome. But these were not just competitive processes, they were also cooperative processes in which organisms could utilize one another to survive. The most easy example is flowering plants and insects, and things like that, or camouflage, organisms which camouflage themselves in their environment. And like I said, this process would take hundreds of thousands of generations and really laid the basis and was a statistical process. The most famous example, really, of him talking about this was on the Galapagos Islands and how this was related to the environment. He looked at two sets of tortoises. Two sets of tortoises. He'd have this tortoise on one island and another tortoise on another island. And he noticed, this tortoise lived on an island that has a very lush environment, a lot of grass. This one looks on a really dry environment, and all the stuff to eat is on these shrubs. And he had suggested, basically, over hundreds of thousands of generations, as these islands became separated, and as they had different environments, These environments essentially select for different properties in the turtle. So turtles which tended to have longer necks would tend to survive, and thereby you have a long-necked turtle versus this short-necked guy. He doesn't need to go anywhere to find his food there on the ground. And also, you can see the shell requires a lot more flexibility. Okay? So again, you're talking about an interaction of generations with a change in environment, and it was their interaction together that produced the outcome. So, so now what had Darwin done? Basically, he had removed the guiding hand of God from this process and really put this process, he just said, acted through forces that were entirely materialist. That is, forces you could see, hear, taste, touch. You could use your senses and measure. And this happened through species interacting with each other, with other species, and with their environment. And that interaction was both competitive and cooperative. And that no change... And none of these changes were automatic or deterministic. They were just millions of possibilities. So where Paley had seen this adaptation as part of a watch and a watchmaker, Darwin saw the suitability due to entirely neutral forces of nature. And most importantly, he said that these forces were not static. And even the tree of life I showed you before, that's just a snapshot in time now. Darwin expects all those things in many ways to change. So the essentialism... The essentialism and teleology, after these ideas, and teleology of the 19th century, had really now been replaced with the historical materialism of the 20th century. And like I said, there were some debates over natural selection, not over the fact of really maybe whether natural selection occurred, but what was the mechanism of natural selection. Darwin knew this as well, that his model would predict a gradual change in organisms. The fossil record really didn't quite add up to that. There were holes in the fossil record or places where things changed suddenly. Now, when I say suddenly, I'm not talking like a generation. It's still hundreds of thousands of years, even millions of years, but it's sudden in comparison to the changes that came before it. And even Thomas Huxley debated Darwin over, like, no, I don't think this is a gradual model. I think change happens kind of slowly, and then there's leaps, and then another change. And this model was called punctuated equilibrium. And many scientists have a more punctuated equilibrium view of how the process of evolution takes place, or descent with modification. The neo-Darwinist view today is also under question. Neo-Darwinism is just basically taking Darwin's theory of natural selection and modern genetics and saying the process by which this happens is an accumulation of mutations. You just get more and more mutations, and so you get this kind of gradual change. But again, the rapid change is harder to explain with these series of mutations, although they have some ideas about it. And there's a really, I felt like I had to show this, even though, man, this is probably not a good idea. This just gets into science and gets into Marxism and stuff, but, you know. This female scientist, Lynn Margolis, I think has come up with a very interesting idea that really is a very different mechanism. Still, it accepts natural selection, but basically says this stuff, these changes don't happen through mutations to the DNA mostly. I mean, she acknowledges some changes in the DNA, but the biggest changes require almost a cooperative model of explaining how these single-cell organisms, bacteria, kind of eventually swallowed up one another, if you will, right here, and the bacteria became part of the cell, and these cells became the basis for organelles like mitochondria for us, or chloroplasts in plants. These photosynthetic bacteria joined with another cell and became chloroplasts. And in fact, there's a lot of physical evidence that suggests, particularly the fact that there's DNA inside of chloroplasts and DNA inside of mitochondria that is similar to bacterial DNA. And so it's a very, very interesting model that I just think is pretty cool. And she, I think, like Darwin, is one of those people who's actually put her ideas to the people, which is what he did with this, and really kind of going around the science community to put forward this debate. And so we'll see. We'll see. I'm predicting she might be right, but we'll see. So what I find fascinating about this is there is actually a genuine debate in the science community, which I didn't actually know about. And what's annoying to me about the creationism and intelligent design stuff is that it obscures a real debate that exists and puts forward this false debate about biblical truth versus the scientific materialist explanation. And like I said, I'm not really going to address this other than to say that the times in this country when you've seen the creationist stuff rise has been in the 20s and in the late 70s and early 80s. Really, those are the two times when these ideas have taken hold. And considering the context of those ideas taking hold in the 20s, you had the Russian Revolution, you had the rise of Bolshevism, you had the rise of communism, and an ideology of the Palmerades and the attack on communism to justify it. So in the New York Lusk Laws, which were very much related to the creationists at the time, they set up this laws for teachers. They said school teachers must obtain certificates of qualification testifying to their moral character, their loyalty to the government, and commitment to conservative political values. Okay, so this is really part of the ideological offense they're trying to use with creationism at the time. And similarly, in the late 70s, you're talking about a response to social liberalism, a women's movement, a civil rights movement, and a gay rights movement that they're looking to put back into the closet. And so I think these debates about intelligent design versus Darwin are not best understood not as science versus religion, but really are political battles. The science versus religion stuff was settled a long time ago with Wilberforce and Huxley. And so we have to understand it really as a political debate. But the real challenge to Darwinism is not found among the kind of the kooky right that puts forward the idea of intelligent design. I think the real challenge is from those on the right and the center of the political spectrum, and I think some people on the left who see in Darwin's explanation of the origin of the species and the struggle for existence, see in that not just an explanation of a biological history, but see an explanation or even a justification for social or human history, particularly capitalism. And they see a world of competition, a world of war against all, or each against all, in a term that Herbert Spencer, not Darwin, describes as survival of the fittest. Okay. And this is what Herbert Spencer says about, that I think encapsulates this notion of survival of the fittest and his notion of descent with modification and natural selection. In the animal world, the old, weak, and sick are ever rooted out, and only the strong and healthy survive. The struggle for existence serves, therefore, as a purification of the race, protecting it from deterioration. This is the happy effect of this struggle, for if this struggle should cease, and each one were sure of procuring its existence without any struggle whatsoever, the race would necessarily deteriorate. The good effect of the struggle for existence can best be seen in wild animals. They are all strong and healthy because they had to undergo thousands of dangers, wherein all those that were not qualified had to perish. Among men and domestic animals, sickness and weakness are so general because sick and weak are preserved. Socialism, having its aim to abolish the struggle for existence in the human world, will necessarily bring about... I'm not sure what he's reading. will necessarily bring about an ever-growing mental and physical deterioration. Now, these ideas of Herbert Spencer may seem extreme, but you know they were the justification for colonialism, for war. They're the justification for eugenics and sterilization, not just by the Nazis, but our own country has done to people abroad and blacks even here at home. Rockefeller justifies capitalist monopoly, all going into one, again, opposite view of evolution. And even the quote by one rich guy who said, millionaires are a product of natural selection. And I read this quote from a prison warden who basically questioned whether inmates should have the right to conjugal visits because they might possess a violence gene that would then be propagated through those two. Even the notion that the wars we see today are some product of innate genetic stuff within us really it has its root in Herbert Spencer's notion. These wars are not because of genes, they're because of greed, because of profit, because of oil, or whatever the war is about. What Herbert Spencer and people who, social Darwinists at the time, see the competition and anarchy of the capitalist system as a mirror, a perfect mirror, of what they see as the blind competitive forces which shaped biological organisms. They see this as in a very essentialist view. This is the perfect person, and capitalism is the perfect system for that perfect person. First, in considering and evaluating social Darwinism, there's two things to consider. One is the time scale of these changes. This is 5 billion years all across here. This is 50 pieces of toilet paper, all right? And Darwin is talking about processes which take place along this whole piece of toilet paper, right? We're talking each single piece of paper is 100 million years, okay? So if you want to consider the time scale for human history, you'd have to take a single piece of toilet paper, and you can do this in your bathroom, and just rub your finger along the edge of that thing, and you're talking about human history right there. It's like 1/500th of a piece of this paper. That's the period you're talking about. So just go to the bathroom, rub your finger along it. That's human history. Okay? So to say that the mechanisms which go over this time frame are somehow the same as the one that are on that edge of the piece of toilet paper, not likely. Not impossible, but not likely. I think the bigger ones are this. are that the notion of descent with modification that Darwin put forward, if you remember, is not NCAA March Madness. It's not like everyone coming down to one. It's not capitalist monoculture or all everyone else destroying everything else and monopoly and those sorts of things. Darwin's theory explains variety, explains diversity, all right, the creation of that, and not monoculture. And of course, there are competitive forces which shape that process, but there are also very cooperative forces that do so as well. And if you anybody today who examines a biosystem is not generally talking about war against all, they're talking about the interaction of systems. It's the basis of modern ecology. All right. So when we look at the ecological view, which looks at the impact of modern production on global warming and ozone depletion, or looks at the genetic modification by some companies in agriculture that produces biodiversity, those things aren't necessarily saying, those aren't necessarily natural forces that produce that. Those are often profit and corporate greed and things like that. Nor are they unnatural forces per se. I mean, those are capitalism. It's a human mode, but it's a social organization that we've kind of decided upon at one level or been imposed that really makes these things happen. I would say they're neither natural or unnatural, and that they're something else. They're some part of our human history. Which brings really us to how would Marx explain this, and why was Marx so excited about Darwin's ideas? And Engels, when he first heard about this stuff, wrote to Marx. He goes, "Darwin, I am reading right now." Oh, Engels said to Marx, he goes, "Darwin, who I am reading right now, is absolutely splendid. There was one aspect of teleology that had not yet been demolished, and now that has been done." And Marx wrote to LaSalle after hearing about this from Engels. Okay, I think 5 minutes. Okay. For the first time, geology in natural science is not only dealt a mortal blow. Oh, no, sorry. For the first time, teleology in natural science is not only dealt a mortal blow, but its rational meaning is being empirically explained. So they saw how teleology, essentialism, were being destroyed in this theory in a similar way that Marx was doing in his own theories of human history. And Darwin, Engels, and Marx all agree that some blind forces, which produced the Galapagos turtle and produced the modern bird from the early raptor, there's no doubt a continuity from those forces to produce Homo sapiens or humans. You can see that right here in the last figure. Humans have been around roughly, Homo sapiens have been around for about 200,000 years, but they acknowledge that humans for the last 2 million years do come from an earlier root. And, you know, not everyone was successful, it turns out. Homo Neanderthalus and Homo erectus didn't quite make it, but you can trace our own history through there. And so they were aware that natural forces would shape that development, but they also knew something else was happening with this organism that really did not really happen to any other organism. And that's why I probably brought out these. Can everyone see those? Okay. Does anybody know why I'm showing these?
No.
Going from here to here to here. This is 400, 500 milliliters, 900 milliliters, and 1.5 liters. Okay. And what you're seeing here over the 2 million years is really the development of the brain size going from the chimpanzee early down here, which would have been the 400 milliliter brain, to around this guy who's about the liter brain, the one in the middle, and then the Homo rhodesius, even Neanderthal had a big brain, Homo sapiens, but that 1.5 liter brain. And it wasn't just the size of the brain, it was the brain in aspect to its body size. A whale has a 9 liter brain, but no one confuses it for anything that's smart. So why was this important for Darwin? And also, what forces caused this development? Darwin and Engels and Marx all agreed that the forces that caused this, and he talks about this in the descent of man, all right, were not like humans decided to get smarter. It was really, they started to stand upright, and they started to use their hands, use tools, do labor. And really, that created the possibility over generations, 2 million years, of selecting for a larger and larger brain as more and more of your operations are taking place with conscious use of a tool and conscious use of your labor to shape the environment. These physical changes, the brain, increase of the brain size, created the circumstance or pressure to select for a larger brain size. These were natural processes that took place in all natural organisms. The natural selection had produced an organism, humans in this case, that had relied more and more over time on the use of tools, on its conscious use of those tools, to shape its environment and recreate the means of its own survival. That is not to say that other creatures didn't do that. There are plenty of creatures that use tools, but they don't rely on it nearly as heavily and don't have as many intricate ways of doing that. It's not even true that we're the only creature with culture and things like that. They've now studied chimpanzees and seen interesting developments of some rudimentary culture among chimpanzees. But humans were the ones that produced the greatest level of complexity in terms of their tools, in terms of their languages, to be, explain how they use those tools, and the cultures and ideologies that came with it. And so really Marxism can be seen as taking human history where Darwin drops it off roughly, probably around there, you know, 200,000 years ago. And neither is disputing that natural forces impact human development, both competitive and cooperative. But really what Marx starts to talk about is the critical development and the ever-growing role of human consciousness and human social organization in becoming the ever-dominant force that governs human history versus the history of other organisms. And really what Marx and Darwin have the most commonality really is in their method, the historical materialist method that gets away from essentialism, that everything has a natural spirit that we're trying to figure out the essence of, or that we're trying to get to that central truth, and replace with a materialistic world and a dialectical world that was a world of probability, of chance, and because of human consciousness, one potentially of imposed human design. And that's really where the biggest differences are between Darwin and Marx. Darwin cites natural forces of reproduction, of heredity, and variety to produce a multiplicity of creatures that he described as these forces of the struggle for existence. Marx acknowledges expresses more the role of human consciousness in shaping human history, and increasingly sees the role of social organization into classes, which has both a competitive and potentially a cooperative forces acting within them, and also the role of ideology, language, tools, and the means, you know, tools like the means of production. Okay. Last page. Great. The means of production to understand its development. So where Darwin saw the struggle for existence in terms of understanding the motor force of history, Marx sees the struggle of contending classes. Neither of these outcomes were inevitable in any case. Inevitable in terms of producing any organism, or inevitable in terms of producing a certain society. But what Marx saw was the very, very heavy role that human consciousness played in determining human history and also human labor. So when we study biological histories, we're studying fossils and DNA and genetics and embryos. When you study human history, you're talking about pottery, about arrowheads, about Rosetta Stones, pyramids, castles, muskets, computers, you know, or airplanes or in computers, you know. Those are the fossils, really, of human history. And those are the tools, really, created by human labor with a human conscious labor in order to shape its environment and interact with the environment. So Marx saw the tools we use, the labor we put into them, the class forces that develop them, and the ideologies which justify them, potentially justifying them in an exploitative way as we exist in today, and potentially in a completely emancipatory way as something that was entirely within our potential control, at least today with the existence of the working class. So really the problem with the social Darwinist model is, one, there's absolutely no scientific evidence for it. All right, it is not science, it's closer to poetry. It's like saying, my love is like a rose. You know, it seems like that, but there's no evidence for it. It's just, it's by, you know. And secondly, this notion of a perfect system for a perfect organism really takes us back to the 19th century, essentialism, teleology, and things like that. And lastly, I think the biggest part of social Darwinism is it really removes this thing from the equation. I mean, the 1.5 liter brain, you know? It basically treats us like we're this. And that works for George Bush. But for the rest of us, we are capable. I mean, and it's very important to understand, no, humans... and. It's very interesting because the biggest critique of Marx and Marxism is like, oh, everyone's the same. You know, they're going to try to make everyone the same. No, we're not going to be the same. The expression of human culture, the expression of human identity and individuality is really what Marxism is central about through the possibility of really emancipating ourselves through the use of our tools and a revolution. And I think that's why Marx was so excited about Darwin and why we should be as well.
So we're going to open it up for discussion. If people have specific questions, feel free to raise them. If there are a lot of questions, Andy may come back into the discussion in the middle, or he may not. If you know the answer to a question, feel free to take it up from the floor, too. Comments, welcome also. So just raise your hand. I'll keep a list. Obviously, I don't know everyone's name, so I might call on you by what you're wearing. And it's a pretty full room, so we'll try to get to everyone who wants to speak, but if you can keep your comments fairly brief, that may be great. That's great. So, let's do that.
Should I just go?
Yeah, the woman with the orange.
Okay. I happened to meet you in the line and decided to come to this because I didn't find anything else exciting, and I am so pleased. I have not yet read Marx and the Manifesto, but I did buy it, and now I know why I bought it, and now I can look at it from a scientific point of view, and I want to tell you how much I really appreciate your presentation in the sense that looking at the social structure, like Darwin looked at the, I always question Darwin's evolution being there is this little thing that he didn't understand, the jumps in history that has to be explained. Like gravity is real and Einstein's theory of relativity is real, but they are only real in certain, parameters. In other words, Einstein's theory of relativity blows apart certain thoughts about others, but when you look at it at a lower level, those laws are perfectly rational. So it's like looking at rational, and in my effort to do the struggle to change this world that I see deteriorating into a self-destructive small brain bush environment, you've given me a really new way of looking at it, and I'm really grateful. So I'm going to take the Communist Manifesto and I'm going to take my knowledge of science and put them together, and I thank you so much for that. So, my comment.
In the brown shirt?
Did I understand you to say that there is probably not a genetic component of some people being more violent than other people? And if that's the case, I mean, I've also heard that there's a genetic component of altruism, and can you make any comments about that?
In the front foot,
yeah, I'm just putting out a call for any books or articles that might be piecing this together, where this was like the only time we hear about it for a while, so I figured to hear about that.
The books, say it a little louder.
Yeah, I'm just wondering if there's any books or articles about this, making this connection, or if this is like the only presentation we'll hear about for a while. Yay!
Okay, this. Go to the books.
In the back, in the black shirt.
Yeah, given the spread of interest in Buddhism today in the West, it's good to point out that the Lord Buddha in his time made the same departure from Vedic with its essentialist thought that the caste system and all human history evolved in dependent co-rising. And this was pointed out very strongly by fine Marxist Buddhist scholars. So I just, that's a wonderful avenue for you to explore, should you wish.
In the front?
Oh, all right. Yeah, I was wondering if it's safe to say that humans taking care of each other, not just ourselves, is a natural thing about humans, if it's natural for humans to take care of each other. Because, I mean, if that's safe to say, then I would assume that violence isn't a... well, I mean, we do it, but I don't know. I don't think violent. There would be a violent gene, because that would go against, assuming that humans are supposed to be taking care of each other. That would be against. That would be unnatural. But maybe you can touch on that.
I really like that question, because I think that the one thing that Marxism contributed to science is historical materialism and the philosophical language that allows us to systematically understand what's going on around us. And there was a fantastic ISR article a couple issues ago that really kind of got at this, that when Andy was talking about like scientists believed in God, it was that God was actually, not God did it, but that that saying that, you know, here's the mechanism by which God created X, Y, and Z was legitimate science. And that, you know, I mean, the fact that, you know, that you know, Marx, you know, sort of turned Hegelian ideas on their head, that, you know, and you know, came up with the idea that you know, the material world, you know, is reality. That, you know, and that you know, that was something that politics, you know, and our understanding of politics was, you know, shaped by, but also science and science's ability to say like we can observe these things and based on that, you know, try to come to a conclusion, try to prove it wrong. You know, that was really revolutionary in science. But you know, and I think that you know, one way to look at the human species, you know, we require an incredible amount of care in our infancy, and so from that we can assume that we lived in some sort of social group. You know, and we are incredibly cooperative, and we have very complex social structures, which also points to us living in, you know, in social groups, and you know, and that kind of looking at it that way rather than you know, looking at the way, you know, what we need as a species and what we, you know, needed throughout our development, rather than sort of a, you know, we can look at like what we project back on human history, like we have wars now, therefore our, you know, hunters and gatherers were just always like killing each other whenever they ran into each other. You know, I think that you know, is it you know, a way that we can, you know, that Marx started to, you know, just, you know, was looking at.
Okay, Sarah will be the next speaker, and someone in this area raised their hand. Okay, Sarah.
Yeah, Sarah from LA. I think I was just thinking about a couple of the questions come together, and to me, it's like when you think about something like altruism or violence. I mean, these things are so complicated and so sort of built into the way that our societies work that I think there's a really compelling argument that, you know, that those things are shaped by the environment that we grow. I teach in LA, and like there are people, some of my students really believe that there's a biological component to criminality, and yet you look at the conditions that people grow up in, and it's like, so, you know what I mean, it explains everything about if you're poor, you're going to steal, you know what I mean, or, you know, not that it's determined that way, but in other words, it's to me, that one doesn't seem that complicated to explain by you know, just the environment that people grow up in. But, you know, and just related to that, I mean, there's, on the question of what can people read, some excellent books about the way that I think that there is no such thing as human nature, because the one thing you can say about human nature is that it changes over time. So one of the books that I like that I read on this recently is the book called The Myths of Male Dominance by Eleanor Beard Leacock, that just talks about if you think that there's something innate about people, it's not, forget the whole male-female thing for a second, if you think that there's something innate about people dominating each other, when you look at societies in history where the way that they get their food is by cooperating, then it's a, you know, human nature looks entirely different altogether, you know, in terms of their own or you know, whatever. But another really thing that I want to say, let's look at something a little bit more complicated than violence or altruism, something like sexuality. And I really like the part, people have been highlighting the book Sexuality and Socialism all weekend, but there's a chapter in it that talks about, I think one of the things about like Darwin saying, you know, it's not linear, there's also no such thing as nature versus nurture. I think we should kind of throw that out and say, actually, there's a really complex interplay between nature and nurture, and these two things act on each other. So that, for example, if you think about pregnant women who live in a time of famine, and it's a man-made famine, that famine is going to affect the sort of biology of the child that's, you know, going to be born. And that's just one example of that. There's a very, very complex interaction between nature and nurture. We shouldn't see it as one or the other.
Okay, I'm getting quite a long list. So if you raise your hand, I have you, but there's a lot of people who want to speak. So I have in the red shirt, and be followed by the woman in the green back.
Yeah, both a comment and a question, I guess, coming off of what Sarah was talking about, and also getting to the question about, is it natural for humans to take care of each other? Because clearly humans are a very social species, and that our species has survived through cooperating. I mean, there's no question that an individual human on its own is doomed, right? And so the only way our species survived was through cooperation in various social structures throughout the course of its history. And so this gets to my question, which is one of the ways in which I attack social Darwinists is the idea that survival of the fittest applies to individuals. And that's not what Darwin's theses were about. It was about survival of species. And that certain species, great white sharks, Yeah, it's about an individual shark. It's going to, like, try and punch as many fish as it can. Human species don't work that way, and that Darwin's ideas are expressing how our species has evolved through cooperating, you know, more or less broad strokes. And so I just wondered if that's sort of an accurate way, I mean, aside from the, like, you know, the amount of residue of toilet paper you can get on one stroke down the thing versus, you know, the span of the Earth's creation, you know, aside from the sort of scientific holes in this idea of this analogy, but very specifically going after it about Darwin is talking about species. Some species there are about individual survival, and others, including our own, are about social interaction, and that is just a misplaced application of the idea.
Have Sid followed by person in the...
I think mine is covered.
Okay,
yes. So I think Sarah addressed the thing about, you know, could a single protein actually explain the vast majority of violence? No, it couldn't. I mean, you know, you can't dismiss the fact that a single gene mutation might change someone's brain chemistry, and it might have some impact on the way that person can interact with the world. But the vast majority of violence and altruism is an entirely social phenomenon. And I actually think that, I mean, the whole method of can we find a gene to explain homosexuality, can we find a gene to explain this or that, it's actually a tendency to avoid social questions. They don't want to explain the social decay of capitalism. By the way, specifically violence, I don't think homosexuality is actually a beautiful thing. Like, I don't think that's a question of social decay, it's a question of the variety of human sexuality. But that it tends us back towards essentialism, really. I mean, it's like that there are certain fixed, unchangeable things in our genes that will express themselves in various ways, and so you just got to lock up a certain percentage of the human population. I think that's the method that's at work there. And then I want to just get to one thing here. Sarah also mentioned the impact of social questions back upon biology in terms of, like, the development of the fetus in a time of famine. And there are certain things like nutrition and availability of minerals that would have a certain definite impact on such development. But even the holy grail of DNA, you know, the holy grail, like, DNA is the one unchangeable thing in your body that maybe is the source from which we can explain certain of our characteristics. It's even been proven, this is a little bit old news now, though, that the environment can change which of your genes express and what your very DNA looks like. I mean, not in a massive way, and I think it's still being explored and looked into, but even though the holy grail of DNA is now being subjected to the question of society and environment and what gets expressed and what doesn't from that, what used to be thought of as the essential unchanging core.
I'm sorry, I skipped you in the back of the room.
Well, Sid said a lot of what I want to say, but I think in the question of violence, I think the most important thing is, I think someone in the front said that it's a complex thing, and that it's actually, violence is a behavior, it's not a genetic trait. Like, things that are traits are like irritability, maybe, right? Or, you know, to a certain extent, levels of anxiety can actually, there are certain chemistries that actually affect that. But anybody, you know, who isn't irritable at different times, right? It's like, that doesn't mean that you act violently, and violence certainly doesn't exist in a vacuum. And so the thing I also want to talk about is just what Sid kind of ended on, this idea that actually our brain chemistry and our DNA can actually change. Like, that's pretty revolutionary, because what that means is that we have the power, if we can change our environment and the outside world, to actually create whole new potentials of, like, what our brain is potentially can do. I mean, the latest thing on, like, you know, consciousness in the brain, like this thing called neuroplasticity, this idea that actually through learning and through practice and through, you know, study, our brain, we can change our brain chemistry and make it so that we are capable of actually more than maybe we were, you know, 5 years ago or 10 years ago, like within a lifetime. And that kind of, I mean, that brings up a huge question, because when I'm looking, the thing that stood out to me is, like, looking at this scale, like, at first, it's these huge blocks, and then you get to the end, like, the edge of the toilet paper, and it's, like, all these, you know, big moments of change happening in a very short period of time. I think what that has to tell us is the immense amount of power we have to actually change things in such a huge way, and this has, I think, real serious, you know, implications when we think about the destruction of the environment, right? Because it's like, that's not a joke, and time is moving faster in that way as well. And so, you know, in a lot of ways, we have to be able to use this kind of science to actually apply to, you know, the fact that we have more agency, really, you know, than I think we have ever had ever before.
Okay. I have a person in the white shirt, we followed by Dave in the back.
One thing about what Tiget said, well, that may be true. I don't think I'm sure we can imply this, but it's certainly not necessary for us to have any more brain potential to actually be able to, to build a world without without environmental disruption and without racism and so forth. Right? I mean, that's a matter of changing our social system. We don't need to change our brain to do that. The brains we have are perfectly capable of doing that if we have as a class, right, take it over. But the other thing, on the question of genetic, component of violence and cooperation, people have taken different. I wanted to bring together some of the things. Basically, there's two different elements there. There's the potential as a species that our genetic makeup as a species has to do multiple different behaviors, and then there's the question of how much genetic effect has on individuals. And I think. I think what we want to separate is two things. Is there a genetic tendency for us to cooperate? I think, as people said, that there are friends and others that our very overall makeup that our genes have produced is designed as a social being. One that can manipulate and use its environment and do so socially in order to survive. We don't have chickens that people are using other people. We don't have hair to live in cold climates. We don't have many of our features are not designed for any one environment, but to actually be able to take advantage of them and manipulate them and everything. And it usually requires social structure to do so. And so there is a definite built-in tendency for us to have a social tendency. We historically have had hunting, as a species, hunting is part of how we survive. And so there is a violent component there. But that does not mean that any individual one person, the levels of one of those things or another is based on their genetic thing. And it also does not mean that we're predisposed necessarily to do one or the other. It has to do with what is our environment in which those potentials are expressed. And in the case of the socialists, the most important part now, is our social environment. We have the ability to overcome the physical limitations of our environment in the world, and it's our social environment that's most affecting how those things are expressed, and the one that we most focus on changing in order to be able to bring up the features that we want, as well as to help us make sure that we don't destroy the world in the process.
Okay, if I wrap you up, it's not because I don't like what you're saying. It's just I'm trying to get to everyone on the list. And I'd like to get to everyone who's raised their hand. So you can make your comments brief. That's excellent. Dave will be followed by person in the second row.
First, that was a great talk, and it gave me new appreciation for when George Galloway called Christopher Hitchens evolution in reverse. a beautiful butterfly to a slug. Altruism gene or violence gene, because it's even connected to people who make arguments from a progressive perspective about the gay gene. Yeah. I mean, we're so caught up in this matrix of ruling ideas of society or the ideas of the ruling class, like our conception of Darwinism and genetics is shaped like that. So you have very good people on our side who speak about a gay gene precisely because they want to shove it in the face of the people who are like, reparative therapy, we can cure you, we're on the Christian right. But then it completely distorts the science of it and it actually makes us less able to take on questions of human sexuality and how it exists. And it's interesting that you talk about an altruism gene or a violence gene. If there's anything that's genetic about humanity that we can point to, it's not even cooperation, it's survival. That's the common thread. And if your society is organized that you need violence to survive, that's a violent society. If it's built around altruism, that's what you see. And there's a wide variety throughout human history of how people have had to organize themselves to survive, and whether it's violence or altruistic or cooperative, that's what grows out of that. I mean, there's a reason why these massive early societies that have existed for human history are called hunters and gatherers and not thieves and killers. It's because it's not that we're trying to kill each other, do this, it's like we're trying to survive. And it's interesting how distorted even the continuum of progress is, because of course humanity has progressed in terms of a brainstem and opposable thumbs, but we're less hairy than we used to be, so we need more clothes. You know, our teeth are less sharp, so we've got to figure out how to cook things. So we've evolved and we've devolved simultaneously. And the one continuum of human history is survival and trying to subjugate nature, because without our ability to do that, then we don't survive. And the last thing to say before I sit down is, like, Marx has that famous quote where he says, "I'm a Marx, but I'm not a Marxist," because he's so absolutely horrified by what people have done in his name towards the end of his life. I think if Darwin was alive, he'd be like, I am no way a Darwinist. I can't be. When you have people using my name to justify things like the bell curve, yep. You have people using my name to justify things like prison construction based on third grade literacy levels. I mean, this is an evil distortion of it. So part of, like, fighting for socialism is about the liberation of science and liberating these ideas so we can actually figure out how we're organized socially to fight for a better world and not to be subjugated by the current one.
Great, yeah, and coming off of that, I think what's more interesting than, I think as people have been saying, than what gene causes violence is why are people constantly looking for the gene that causes violence. And it's actually because the existing ideas are the ideas of the people in control, and they'll have all sorts of philosophers and priests and everyone else trying to convince us, and even scientists to a certain degree as well. I think you can misuse it. You mentioned Malthus in the talk. You know, basically it was a reaction to the poor laws. You know, Industrial Revolution brought people off the land into the cities, and it meant that a lot of people no longer even had subsistence land to live on, which meant that you had periods where people were, there was famine, there was unemployment, and as a result, in the mid-1800s, there were poor laws that people thought were a good idea to at least keep people from roaming around and starving to death. But then you had a whole reaction to that that said people shouldn't actually help anyone else. And so Malthus's argument about overpopulation is that, well, we don't want to actually help feed the poor people because then there's not enough food and they're just going to, you know, keep on growing and growing and there's not going to be enough for all of us. And I actually wanted to point out that Marx was a big arguer of that. And he really, a lot of the ways that he argued against it was... talking about that the problem wasn't there's too much food and it's going to make people just grow at this insane rate, but the problem was really one of employment. And I think for understanding the history of these ideas' development, this is a great book by John Bellamy Foster I've been reading called Marx's Ecology. And then especially the idea of ecology is important because we're hearing from people now from Portland a lot that to help people in other countries or the idea of helping people and feeding people is going to lead to this overpopulation problem. So it's the same argument that they had a long time ago trying to justify why we don't want to help people who've been put in a bad situation. I think we're doing the same thing that Marx did when he pointed to the real source of the problems in the world, the real reasons why overpopulation is a problem, is that capitalism is one that... overpopulation under capitalism was therefore determined not simply by the existence of a relative surplus population of workers seeking employment and thereby means of subsistence, but more fundamentally by the relations of production that made the continual existence of such a relative surplus population actually necessary for the system. So the system actually needs people to be on the street and to be hungry and to be rotating workers to exploit in order to continue. So it's really the system and not the amount of food that is out there.
In the front, in the front, sure.
Okay. One of the things about this talk that I really appreciated was being able to appreciate the interplay between you know, these two pieces of toilet paper right here, biological development, and then the relationship with that of the physical world. But then also, I think, when we're talking about human society, we can talk about the relationship between that and the society in which we live. And I think when we're talking about, we can't have an overly simplistic view of the way, like Sid was saying, the way that genes and proteins relate to our characteristics. Some of the things we have that Andy talked about is we have large brains. One of the things you did mention this, we have a brain that makes us able to use language, which is one thing, and we're able to create and make tools, which means we can do a whole wide range of things. One of the things that we can do is hunt and gather. You know, that's one of the things. But if that guy in that show who gets dropped in the desert really can't survive alone, you know, that's something else we can do. I don't know if he's really alone. He has all his cameras and stuff. Does everybody know that show I'm talking about? But it also, growing up under capitalism, it brings out, it can bring out some of the worst in people when you look at the military as an institution that's part of our environment. It takes people, you know, young kids and turn, you know, it teaches them these racist ideas. You know, can you say there's a racist gene? I don't think you can say that. That's an example, and our society also creates things like war and imperialism. Can you say there's, you know, a gene for war, a gene for imperialism? And no, I think as materialists, we have to be able to trace those things back to the way our society is organized, and to be able to understand, just as we are able to hunt and gather, just as we are able to actually create this incredibly complex society that of capitalism, we are able to use our same brains and our same hands and create tools to actually liberate humankind and actually create something different. And I think that's also one of the amazing things about, you know, we're talking about here today.
Okay, we are getting short on time, so there's going to be two last speakers, which will be in the back with glasses, followed by in the front with the brown shirt.
Oh. I know it's really empowering just to focus on veteran society, but I think the stronger discount than age society. If you guys a little bit, if you learn about science, if you read about science, they're going to find more and more things that are genetically based. So with like twin studies, that's the classic example.
Yeah.
And so what I'm saying is, okay, you got to kind of know what you're up against. I mean, like, take your own human nature. There is a tendency to want to do certain things, and you got to kind of fight it consciously a lot of times. So I think knowing that, I would recommend watching a really good documentary on like chimpanzees, because what you find is that they have a lot of violence. But what it is, it's projected against the out group. The in group, they're pretty cooperative. But if another chimpanzee troop comes in, they will kill them, by the way. They'll gang up on each other and kill them. And we're like 99% the same as chimps. So, but, you know, the world is getting bigger. We can't survive with it. It's another idea that's been developed in Darwin's group selection. You know, like one group is going to be selected against another. But, you know, the world is coming up against each other. All the groups are coming up against each other now. We're all, you know, connected together, so I don't think that mode will work anymore. But you got to at least know that tendency is there for aggression, but also for cooperation. And kind of what we have to do is break down the idea of what our group is, you know, and start to see the others as part of our group, too.
Okay, well,
I'm
just going to say something different, but I have to respond. Everybody knows about the bonobo, right?
Yes.
Okay, so that's the other, I don't even know what to call, primate, that has almost the exact same genetic composition as human beings. And unlike the chimpanzee, it's not violent at all. Like, they solve all their problems by having sex, basically. Like, oh, you can't have, let's have sex. I mean, that's bonobo. So we have that genetic tendency, too. So I think the whole thing, like, really, like, you know, human nature is distinguished by its adaptability and its ability to change. And I think a lot of people have talked about that. I think, I'm not exactly sure why people want to explain things about genes, but, you know, anyway. My brother-in-law's brothers are twins. They're identical twins. And one is gay and one is not. And so one identifies himself as gay and the other one does not. Now, like, what's an interesting, useful way to look at that question? Is one of them in the closet? You know, they have the same genes, right? So, like, I don't know, the whole question of genes determining, like, who we are and what we do, I think it oversimplifies everything about human existence, and I don't understand, like, why people cling to it. The thing that Sid was saying about it being very complicated, you know, I was recently studying women in sports, and women in the Olympics used to have to prove that they were women, and the first way that they proved that they were women was that they had to parade naked in front of judges, and then that was deemed to be too humiliating. They had to prove they were women because if they were men, you know, competing as women, they would win because men are better than women at everything. So they had to prove that they were actually women and were going to compete with each other. So the women were like, that sucks, I don't want to parade naked in front of you guys anymore. And so they started doing chromosome checks. And what they found with the chromosome checks, it was very interesting, is that people, notice I say people, who had been gendered as women actually had Y chromosomes for a variety of different reasons. Usually it was like they had something else going on that caused testosterone to be suppressed, et cetera, et cetera. So the whole question of, you know, gender even, something that people see as just completely, like, this total strict dichotomy, is not really that way. And I think that the more you study this, the more varied it becomes. And then I have a question, which is, whenever I'm talking about this, and I'm talking about how the brain formed because of using our hands, and It's prehistorical. What do we really know, and how do we know it in as much detail as you possibly can?
Okay. Thank you, everyone. This is a fantastic discussion. Yes, we will. Don't worry. We did start 10 minutes late because people were coming in for registration, so we might go 5 minutes over, but there is a half an hour break before the next session. So before Andy comes back, just a few quick announcements. The Haymarket Bookstore is open at two locations, downstairs in the auditorium, and also at the other building where the conference is taking place, 110 Cass Street, where there's a huge selection of books. They'll both be open throughout the day. If you'd like to become a member of the International Socialist Organization or to learn more about what it means to join, we're hosting a special session today at lunch from 1 to 2, which is an intro to the ISO, and the location and everything is in your program. So bring your lunch, and it's at 110 Cap Street. Join us there. Check your schedule to see where the next meeting is located. It does take about 10 minutes to walk from one building to the other. And please make sure to wear or show your Socialism 2009 ID card when you enter the next session. If you lose your ID or your ticket, go to the registration table to get a new one. So I need to wrap up.
Yeah, it seems like there's another talk we have to have next year about jeans, which I'd love to give that one now. But I'll say something about the evidence about the brain formation, which is, I think for me was very fascinating because I didn't quite know this. There's always a kind of debate, what comes first, the kind of consciousness or being, like material circumstances? It's quite clear, material circumstances. You look 2 million years ago, you date those rocks of radioactivity, 2 million years old rocks, you start to see the remains of creatures who were beginning to walk, where they now understand we're walking upright, but they see rudimentary sticks, petrified, and stones that have been shaped. They see those things next to those fossils, and they go, oh, 2 million years ago, here you go. That's when it started. And that's when you start to see the cranium get bigger and bigger, and you start to see a development slow of some of those stones and other sorts of tools that developed through that time. That's a short sketch of what that evidence is. But what I find interesting of that is material, then consciousness, really, which I think is even what the Marxists talk about, the base and superstructure in some ways. Sorry to throw out those terms. Genes. Okay, I'm just going to say this about genes. Here's the problem for us humans. When they did the Human Genome Project, and they took the entire genome for the fruit fly, for the worm C. elegans, and for the humans. Fruit flies have 10,000 individual genes. Cool. Fruit flies have 20,000 individual. Worms have 20,000 individual genes. Humans, they expected to have 200,000, 250,000. We got 40,000, which means there's no way of understanding the complexity of ours as an organism by basing single genes. Okay. Now here's what you can say: they've linked to single genes. Sickle cell anemia, single gene with a single mutation. Da-da. Cystic fibrosis, single gene, single mutation. The other one, if you're a guy, if you had ear hair on your Y chromosome, there's a gene which gives you that ear hair. Okay, that's pretty much it. Okay, I mean, what we figured out so far. That's good and bad. That means if we do gene therapy may be able to cure sickle cell anemia, may be able to cure cystic fibrosis.
Ear hair.
But because it's clear that there's an interaction of these genes between each other, it's complex, and there's an interaction between those genes and the organism in nature. That's just not true for humans. That's true for all these creatures. Even single-cell creatures, which are normally single-cell, you put them in some environment, they group together. And in some other environment, the cells within that group start to differentiate a little bit. So even single-cell organism, the gene expression is related to the environment. It's much more complex with us. Now, I'd go back and say to you, like, okay, yeah, we're 98.6% similar. Not 98.6% similar in terms of world, you know, Empire State Building. I mean, I don't see monkeys creating that. You know, that's a big difference. You know, wars of the scale that kind of. I mean, so you can't use that similarity. Yeah, 98.6% genetic, and yet we have completely different cultures. I mean, so I would say, in unreally understanding what's the dominant force, is it genetics or is it human consciousness and social organization? Social organization. I mean, gravity operates on both this piece of paper and this book, right? Mm-hmm. Gravity operates on both of them. But they go down completely two different ways. The book falls like a rock, and this paper seems to be drifting, you know, because other forces are operating in it. Human consciousness is kind of like, is like the dominant force, really. And social organization is the dominant determinant for human behavior. That's how I think Marxists would look at it today. It's not saying genes. There's some air currents kind of infecting this a little bit. But by and large, you drop this book 10 times, it's going to drop the same way. The paper, different every time. That's more like genetics play a little bit more of these other things that don't have human consciousness. I think that's the analogy I would probably use. And the last thing I'll say is I guess I want to start with what you said, which is really what I kind of hope to come out of this talk, which is science is not just for Darwin. It's not just for Marx. It's actually for all of us. It's actually, and even Darwin's approach to science is for all of us, to really take a, we should be very like, okay, this is what we think is going on. We should have a very honest assessment of what things fit, what things don't. That's the approach. That's what Marx had for the entire working class. He's like, working class people can be scientists. There should be no distinction, all right? Scientists in terms of shaping their own world. The reason I think that's important is this thing. Because Darwin, said, look at all these possibilities, for biological, creatures and things like that. I think Marx sees a similar thing. Marx talks about the possibility. If we're here, he talks about socialism or barbarism. All these things are not predetermined, all right? It can be either one. It can be any variety. But what we do today and what we decide to do today can matter in that factor. And that's what I think is so liberating about this, is it says we actually can play a role in shaping which way we go on this journey. Does it become barbarism and nothing good? Or does it become socialism, something I think is much better, all right? And doing that earlier, I would say, in terms of talking about why you might want to join today. Doing that earlier, you can have more of an impact, to be honest. I'll leave it at that with a recruiting pitch.